is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, bang, bang, looks like the Fed is running out of ammo as, for the first time, negative interest rates, which are plaguing much of the world, imparted policy in Europe, this week in Sweden, and last week in Japan, could be coming to the U.S. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Up in Hour 1, Tracy Knutson will be joining me from Lowy's Research. She's just not seeing a lot of buying pressure coming into this market to hold it up. Selling pressure continues to build. She doesn't see a bottom in this market at this time, so she'll be here in Hour 1. Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about the big events of the market this week, and Frank Holmes will join me later on in the program as we talk about gold. How about that? Big movement in gold this week. What is that saying? It's related to what went on Capitol Hill this week. All of that in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. Maybe it should be bang, bang, click, click, oh, crud. Because if they run out of ammo, what's your backup plan? And maybe there is no plan B right now. You know, we have a lot to discuss on the big picture here today. Our first part of the big picture is going to be called Bad Moon Rising, because there are indicators that are indicating negative directions clear across the board, from the S&P 500 to the Euro STX, the Nikkei Index. The only thing that's been up, as a matter of fact, is gold, finally, after a long melee. So we're going to take a look at the indicators, what they're telling us about the direction in which we are headed as an economy. And it's no secret, you know, there they said it. They talked about negative interest rates this week during Chair Yellen's testimony before Congress, before both the House and the Senate. Could the central bank, the Federal Reserve, actually back into negative interest rates if they had to do it? And the basic bottom line on that is, yes, it's at least on the table. So what does that tell us as far as the ammunition the Fed has to use in the event of another blowout vis-a-vis 2007-2008 in the economy? And the answer is probably only quantitative easing and negative interest rates, which means there isn't any wiggle room. So we have much to speak about coming up on the big picture in the second hour of the program. And Ryan Poplava, we got some one-on-one time with Chair Janet Yellen this week, actually more like FaceTime with Congress, a lot of it actually. How did the markets react to this, by the way, and what were the other main stories this week that influenced the markets, would you say?
Well, I say, John, that she didn't really add a whole lot of new information since the January statement. It wasn't that long ago. But she did give a decent nod to short-term falling inflation worries and uncertainty created by financials and global developments, which, you know, have prevented the Fed from forming a real clear path for rates. On top of, you know, just given, I think, some of the economic news we've been seeing over the past month and a half, she acknowledges that the fourth quarter wasn't that great at this point. You know, two themes I thought were relatively new in her conversation and some of the comments we heard from her was she talked about and broached the conversation about the appreciation in the dollar. Now, normally, John, the Fed avoids that topic. It says the dollar is the domain of the Treasury. But I think, even though, you know, she's a very much an academic, I think she understands that the differential between other central banks and our central bank is important in that very fact alone. I mean, she acknowledged that, you know, the dollar has appreciated and that has really affected financial and global developments. So she actually mentioned it many times. You know, additionally, though, she said the Fed is re-examining, that's meaning they've looked at it in the past, maybe 2010, 11, and 12, at negative rates. And, you know, the drums have been beating pretty loud in that side of the conversation. And I'd say comments from her on this issue did probably more bad than good, given, you know, banks recently have been under a lot of pressure on top of all those tech stocks at the beginning of the week and at the end of last week. If you remember our discussion about data, DATA, you know, Tableau, with their earnings, we've seen some weakness there. But financials, a lot of weakness there, a lot of pressure due to rising credit risk and capital concerns, especially in Europe. And there was a Wall Street article over the last weekend highlighting the risk in high yield credit. And, you know, we have a lot of banks obviously very much invested in that area, underwriting, et cetera. You know, maybe the credit risks we see in high yield may be shifting to investment grade as we're looking at spreads versus treasuries continue to widen in that segment of the market. So I think the talk and the discussion over negative rates was a negative for the market, you know, just on the heels of what we've seen in Japan recently. I mean, there, John, you know, we continue to see just weakness in financials over there and weakness in general from the Japanese market as the Bank of Japan went to negative rates 2 weeks ago. And recently this week, their 10-year Japan government bond, the JGB, slipped to negative rates as well. That was a very big headline, I think, on Tuesday. So, you know, when Yellen started talking about negative rates, sour taste in the market, and that left us lower through the week until about Thursday intraday.
Yeah, it was interesting during Chair Yellen's testimony that there was some discussion about negative interest rates, which means, well, maybe they're thinking about it or something like that. But
they just raised rates. We're talking about.
I know. That's what I mean. It's just Micah Sweden back further into negative territory this week. But oil, you said dollar and oil are the two major drivers affecting the market. So if we swing the spotlight over to OPEC, any news of production cuts on that side?
Of course, every week.
And you believe them, right?
I'm trading on them. You can trade on the headlines because the market does move on the headlines. But, you know, the correlation between oil and stocks is high. So yes, we definitely want to look at oil, what's going on in production, supply and demand. So any kind of headlines and comments from agencies about that is going to hit the tape directly. And it did happen. Saudi Arabia and Venezuela met early in the week, but the issue as everyone knew about it, but we didn't hear anything about it afterwards. In other words, no agreement or anything officially out of that. So that helped, I think, to send oil lower below 30. And technically, it was just breaking down from last week. And that sent the S&P 500 lower with it. Very high correlation. Later in the week, we continue to see just the roller coaster every week here in the markets. Volatility is high. If you look at the VIX, I think I looked at it yesterday. It was up elevated around like 28. And that's a pretty high level for the VIX indicator for the past couple of years. So volatility is high. And given that, we did see a rally in oil later this week on OPEC rumors of a production cut. What do you know? Something new. There was an announcement intraday on Thursday, and that was really right in line with the S&P rallying. And that was right after we tested those January lows. So you think the traders would know better by now regarding these production cut rumors. But, you know, if you're short and you're leveraged in futures and a headline like that could potentially squeeze you, well, you know, if you're just running the space, you're getting out, asking questions later. You know, both oil and stocks rallied and were able to hold, the S&P rather was able to hold those January lows. So I think the technical backdrop, you know, that helped with the market towards the end of the week. Retail sales figures on Friday were better than expected. You know, regarding financials, Jamie Dimon said that he bought $26.6 million worth of his JP Morgan stock. And that helped to support an area that has been very weak as of late. So yes, which of these do you really want to dive into? I'd say there's still probably a lot of discussion we can go into, especially on the financials.
Well, speaking about diving, let's go back to the bank issue. I want to dive deeper into banks. Negative rates don't seem to be the solution that the market wants. We were talking about them earlier. You said that the banks rallied this week with all of the talk over negative rates. So what gives with this?
The banks didn't rally over the discussion of negative rates. In fact, they were hurt. Sorry if I give the other opinion. I think this roller coaster, John, like I said, really day to day depends on the headlines. What headlines are in the paper? That's going to tell you how things are going to trade. You're getting negative commentary from banks about their outlooks for 2016. You know, the market's going to slide. Banks are going to slide. Central banks as well. Any kind of discussion on negative rates, that's negatively affecting banks. That's a major driver. Rising credit default swaps on European bank debt. That has been a concern for us. We've been monitoring it. We monitored it all in 2010, 11, and 12. That was a very key indicator we followed. Really reversed when the Central Bank of Europe announced their long-term refinancing operations, LTRO. We really saw everything kind of curb back after that. But Deutsche Bank, I would say if we're looking at any kind of bank in Europe right now, they're at the epicenter of that discussion, and they announced some major purchases this week in their senior notes to kind of recapitalize. So that was a positive for the banks seen early in the week. But, you know, all this negative talk on rates, I mean, talk that was on negative rates, you know, that was all very negative on Thursday after all these comments from Yellen. And then also Societe Generale's cautious outlook for 2016 didn't help either. So the other subject, you know, negative central bank rates, you know, not just capitalization of what's going on in Europe, credit risk, all this discussion about negative rates, that does not help banks. So long-term market yields are the other area that hurt profitability. So if we have low profitability with low spreads between short-term and long-term for the banks to really capitalize, and if they have nowhere to put money, if they give it to a central bank to hold on to, they're not going to get any return. They're going to get negative return if we're talking about negative rates. So the outlook for financials was pretty dire up until this point. So, and then you look at Japan. After the Japan government went to negative rates 2 weeks ago on the 29th of January, their market has been in nothing but a free fall. I think the last time I calculated, it was down like 14.5% from that point. And then Yellen talked about negative rates. The Riksbank, I think you mentioned earlier in the show, Sweden, the central bank going further into negative territory. That didn't help banks. So, but like I said, it's been a roller coaster, John. We got positive comments coming out of a Credit Suisse conference this week on the financials. Many companies presented, and they said, you know what? Actually, for them, they said the conditions are a lot more sanguine than the market is voicing in these credit default swaps. You know, credit default swaps, how are those moving? It's market speculation, John. It's hedge funds running up these premiums. So the banks themselves are saying that's not really painting the picture that we're seeing. So when you couple those comments with, you know, a big name like Jamie Dimon, you know, making purchases in his own stock to the tune of $26.6 million, investors start looking at it differently. So, you know, I looked at recent price to book valuations on many of the banks, many of which have just been in a free fall. Look at Morgan Stanley, you know, some of the investment banks, some of the brokers, and just a lot of carnage there over the past couple of months since the Fed raised interest rates. But here, I think, let's see, JP Morgan and Wells Fargo, those were the only two that I looked at with price to book valuations above one. So most of them, you know, are being priced below what their book value is, which is what a lot of investors look at to price some of these for a possible purchase. So very interesting week in financials, to say the least. But I have also seen that it's not just Jamie Dimon. There are actually other directors and officers that are buying shares of their companies. So that was definitely a positive end of the roller coaster week in financials.
Yeah, it really was eventful. Although if you look at it, everything's been eventful since we started the new year.
I know. To start off negative like we have.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think investors should be watching next week as potential catalysts in this whole area?
There's so many moving parts, John, and there really is so much important information out there on oil. Anything we get on oil is going to be important. Any headlines on bank capitalizations, any headlines on these CEOs, officers, anybody buying more, the insiders buying, that's going to be important. But economics, I think, are probably the key right now to, I think, investor stability and equities. And the markets will be closed on Monday for President's Day. So nothing to do, obviously, there. But interestingly, the Chinese market will open for the first time in a week. Hong Kong opened negatively when it did in the middle of the week. So it'll be interesting to see what China does to catch up with recent events. But a lot of economic news. So we're going to get the first look at February's regional manufacturing numbers from New York State and the Philadelphia Fed surveys. We'll get that on Tuesday and I think Thursday. But the big one will be, to me, is the industrial production number on Wednesday and then the conference board's leading indicators on Thursday. So those are some big numbers to watch and will definitely steer investor sentiment. But the other thing too are these conferences. You know, the Credit Suisse one on banks really kind of changed the trend a little bit. And we're going to get some in consumer companies. And also there's an industrial investor conference as well. So maybe, just maybe, the micro conversation may affect some of that macro driven market. But, you know, we'll see.
Well, I will say that this year has been really interesting. I'm not sure interesting is a good word or a bad word, but at least it's anything but dull and mundane, right? You know, so
it's gives us definitely some ammunition.
Yeah, I agree. All right, Ryan Poplava, look forward to next week and see if we can match it in excitement.
I'll see what those economic indicators show.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Investors are putting their focus back onto both European and Italian banks. We've seen some major banks in Europe, like Deutsche Bank, fall precipitously into the start of this year. And some are down even as much as 50% going back from their highs of last year. George Friedman joins us today to speak about this on his recent note, The Lurking Crisis of Bank Deposits. And George, tell us what's going on here, because you write that the Italian banking crisis has moved to its next inevitable stage. What do you see taking shape?
Well, Greece was not an outlier. It was a forerunner. And a lot of the battles that were fought in Greece were precursors to a much larger one, which is Italy. The Italians have non-performing loans at 17% officially. That's a very flexible number. You can go up or down. But since most of the non-performing loans are corporate loans, we'll say that about a quarter of the assets of banks are at risk. And that's the largest ones are the most at risk. Now, that makes perfect sense because Europe has been in a massive recession. The Italians have been constrained in putting stimulus into their economy. And southern Italy has 20, 22% unemployment, which is catastrophic. Okay? So something had to give. Something had to give. And what is beginning to give is the numbers are starting to be published. They were ignored, then they were published. And the next phase of this thing is as it becomes clear that there's this massive problem with these banks, depositors are pulling their money out. And in pulling their money out, they contract the asset risk base. They force them to have higher reserves. They cut back on lending. It becomes a nasty spiral. Now, the question has become, how safe are deposits in Italian banks? And the European Union came out with a very interesting claim, which basically categorized depositors as investors. So where we're heading, this is obviously a political issue. It's not an economic issue. And we are heading to a political showdown that could tear the EU apart.
Well, for investors, it hasn't been a pretty picture this year. A flight to safety as the price of gold rises to levels we haven't seen in years, and Treasury yields, thought to be rising this year, are heading lower. Joining me on the program is Tracy Knutson from Lowry's Research. Tracy, let's begin with the stock market. It is not a pretty picture on the day we're doing this interview. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down over 300 points, and the S&P is having an ugly day as well, down almost 37 points here. What's your take on the market? What are your indicators of buying and selling pressure telling you?
Our indicators of buying power and selling pressure, which are Lowry's intermediate term measures of the trends of supply and demand, indicate we're in a bear market. Selling pressure was recently at a new rally high. Buying power is near a multi-year low. We're seeing weak trends in demand, strong trends in supply, and as long as this continues, we think we're going lower. And today's decline, you see declines like this in bear markets. Even the market was not oversold coming into today's session, and it could very well be oversold if today's losses hold. But that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to get a significant bounce in the near term. In a bear market, you can remain oversold for extended periods of time, which we saw back into that January low. So we think we're going lower. We're seeing all the signs of a weak market, a bear market that's got more to go on the downside, and today is just a function of that, where you see sellers. We saw the last 2 days the market tried to rally intraday. Sellers stepped in, and now obviously sellers are in firm control today.
So when you see a lot of selling like you are today, no buying pressure coming in to offset that, you have another indicator that you use, which is an advanced decline line that takes out a lot of the interest-oriented stocks, because basically with interest rates falling lower, those type of entities are doing much better. What is that indicator telling you? Is this pretty broad-based?
It's very broad-based. In fact, recently we separated those advanced, the operating companies only advanced decline line is what you're referring to, where we strip out all the interest sensitive issues that are traded on the New York and all we look at are common stocks. We recently broke those advanced decline lines down into, by segmentation, large cap, mid cap, and small cap. Even before today's sell-off, the OCO, operating companies only mid cap advanced decline line was at a new multi-month low. The small cap OCO advanced decline line was at a new multi-month low. And large caps, we've seen deterioration in large caps. It was not at a new low as of yesterday's close. As of today, it could very well be because we are seeing selling start to migrate over into big caps. So what we saw as this major market top was forming was deterioration first in small caps. That was clear. We started warning our clients back in 2014 to watch out for small caps. We were starting to see deteriorating breadth, which is what the advanced decline line measures, the degree of participation in a rally. Then that selling started to migrate more over into mid caps, and now we're seeing it broaden out into large caps, and that's being reflected in our OCO advanced decline line.
And usually as a bear market unfolds, aren't the last stocks to fall are the big large cap blue chips? Because as things weaken or news gets bad, there tends to be a gravitation towards larger cap, more liquid type stocks. So is that why they're the last to go?
Yeah, people tend to, you know, hold on to the safest stocks. The large caps, we saw many of them hold up very well, even as mid and small caps were essentially imploding. But we're starting to see more weakness come into those stocks, which had been doing very well. Just an example, Facebook was recently at a new bull market high in early February. Well, that since has sold off dramatically. Another proprietary indicator that we have here at Lowry is called our power rating, which is a measure of demand for individual stocks, sectors, industry groups. We also calculate an average power rating for the broad market. The power rating for Facebook has broken down, and it's leading the stock lower, and the power rating is a leading indicator. So it suggests those stocks that had been holding up well, showing positive relative performance, are now starting to weaken. I'm just looking at a couple other charts right here. Visa, that had been holding up well, but now we're seeing it come down, tested a key support level, and our power rating, which, as I stated, is our measure of demand, is trending lower. So we are starting to see those areas of the market where folks had remained in, went to the flight to safety, those big cap names, which, you know, tend to hold up best during the formation of a major market top. Now selling is starting to migrate into those areas.
Yeah, is this something also, I know that Lowry's follows international indexes. It seems like there could be a potential financial crisis brewing in Europe within their banking system. Is this universal in terms of what you're seeing in terms of a bear market? In other words, are other major indexes around the world breaking down as well?
Yes, we cover 22 international markets in Lowry Global, 12 European markets, 4 Asian markets, 5 emerging markets in Canada. We are seeing bear markets across the board. Selling has been particularly heavy in Europe. You know, obviously, you've got the banks over in Europe imploding. We also calculate buying power and selling pressure for each of those 22 international markets, and we're seeing increasing supply, in some cases surging supply, and diminishing demand. No area right now seems safe. There were some markets that looked like they could display positive relative performance where internals were not weakening as much as other countries that we cover, but they're selling in those areas of the market has started to take hold as well. In fact, they're playing some catch-up to the weakness that we've seen. Even Japan, which had had a nice rally when they moved to the negative interest rate policy, there was nothing behind that rally as far as our indicators showed, and we noted that in our comments to subscribers, be careful on this rally. We're not seeing strength behind it. And indeed, the market has since turned sharply lower. Any demand you're seeing come into these markets is being met by selling.
You know, one of the deceptive things about the market last year is you had a small group of stocks that were leaders, the FANG stocks, the Facebooks, the Amazons. What are you seeing? Are they breaking down even more so? Now, on the day you and I are speaking, Tesla stock got a nice pop in it. I guess they say they're going to produce more cars, but it's certainly down from where its peak was. Are the FANG stocks breaking down as well?
Well, I've already mentioned Facebook. Yes, that's starting to deteriorate. Google, I just pulled up that chart. Our power rating for Google, again, our measure of demand, Google made on a weekly basis a new rally high at the end of 2015, but our power rating did not confirm that high. It made a lower high, which we call a negative divergence. And that is an indication that even though you might be seeing strength in the price of the stock, you're not seeing demand supporting that strength. And indeed, Google has sold off. It rallied back, tested the highs on just a week ago, just over the past few days, looking at a weekly chart here. But our power rating, again, made a lower high. It did not confirm that strength. So, yes, we are seeing that Google start to break down. I had already mentioned Facebook. Let's take a look at Amazon. Amazon has dropped sharply lower from its highs. Our power rating, is leading on the downside. When you see more weakness in the power rating than you see in the price of the stock, it suggests you've got more to go on the downside. And Netflix, you formed classically what in technical analysis we call a double top. That double top is in the process of getting confirmed, and the power rating has honestly dropped like a stone. So we are seeing all of those stocks turn lower, and it appears as though their ability to hold up in what we see as a bear market is just not going to play out.
You know, the interesting thing about what's going on right now, the U.S. economy has been slowing, but typically, Tracy, you see these bear markets and stocks develop with recessions and aggressive rate hikes coming from the Fed. I guess what makes this unusual, the economy, albeit it's slowing down, it's still growing, and 0.25 point rate hike would certainly not be considered, let's say, aggressive Fed policy. So I guess the question is this looking more like a major bear market, a moderate bear market, or let's say a mama bear market, or something else?
Well, we don't place too much stock in trying to determine targets in terms of the depth of a bear market. I think that's largely guesswork. And regardless of what's happening, with the economy, with rates, we're just going to watch those forces of supply and demand to let us know how far this market is going to decline. As it stands right now, we're not seeing anything to indicate that a major bottom is on the horizon. We will be watching interest rates, how that impacts the market, but our key concern here is going to be the trends of supply and demand. You've seen the European banks just get decimated. Could that flow over into the U.S. banks? They're underperforming today. Last I checked, they were the worst performing sector of the market. Obviously, energy has gotten crushed, and now we're starting to see significant weakness in other areas of the market. If we see continued weakness in energy, which we do not see any signs of accumulation, we think energy stocks have more to go on the downside. And we're seeing weakness broaden out in financials and become more intense as far as selling is concerned. If this intense selling continues, yes, this could be quite a decline. The Russell is already down 27% from its high that it was formed back in June of 2015. S&P, that's as of early today, what the market was doing, the S&P down 14%. We think we're in a bear market, and we certainly think the S&P is going to go down in excess of 20%.
One of the things that is sort of misleading when you take a look at the indexes, which are down, 8, 9, 10%, the average stock within the S&P is down over 20%. So, these 20% numbers you just cited that may apply to the broader index, the stocks within those indexes are down even more.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of deterioration. We calculate the percent of stocks down 20% or more in the S&P indices as well as in our operating company only universe. And as of yesterday's close, as far as our operating companies only database is concerned, the number of stocks down 20% or more was at 52%. And that's pretty significant.
Wow.
But we've done studies and gone back to major market bottoms and found that the percent of stocks down 20% or more can balloon as much as 90% at a bear market low. So we're at 52% right now. We think this selling is going to broaden out, and this number will expand before we reach our final low.
So in terms of what you're seeing right now, you don't see any sign of a bottom yet, given what we're seeing, especially on days like this where you're seeing broad-based selling. And as you mentioned, 52% of the stocks in the S&P are down over 20%. Tracy, what would you have to see to tell you that we're close to a bottom or even a turnaround, that maybe the bear market has ended? What would have to improve for you to change your opinion?
Well, we're going to be looking at numerous indicators that we follow at Lowry's: buying power and selling pressure. What we should see heading into a major market low is the increase in selling pressure start to abate. My colleague Dick Dixon and myself wrote a book that was published several years ago where we examined every major market bottom and met every major market top dating back to the 1960s in terms of what Lowry's indicators did during those tops and bottoms. And as far as bottoms are concerned, there's a consistent pattern of selling pressure starting to abate prior to a major market low. That means essentially you're seeing less selling come in. At the same time, we should see buying power either stabilize or start to increase to suggest you've got more demand coming into the market. Even though prices may still be moving lower, you're starting to see some accumulation take place, which is what buying power will tell us. We also have the indicator I'd mentioned for individual stocks, the power rating. We have an average power rating that we look at Lowry, which is calculated off of roughly 1,000 of the most heavily traded stocks in the New York and the NASDAQ. And we should see, number one, that reach an extremely oversold level. We're not anywhere close to levels it's reached at prior bear market, at most prior bear market lows. And we should see that indicator start to show signs of strength. For example, 2008-2009, the average power rating at the March 2009 market low established a higher low. So we had something that we refer to as a positive divergence. And that suggests that even though the market made a lower low, the average power rating, even though it was at a very low level and very oversold, was indicating you were seeing some demand come into the market. Those three indicators, as well as some other indicators, the percent of stocks above their 30-week moving average, we should start to see stabilization in that indicator. The spread between buying power and selling pressure, we'll be watching that for an extreme reading as far as when we might be near a low. So we're going to be watching several metrics here at Lowry to indicate when we think a bottom may be close at hand. You know, we're just not seeing that right now. We saw some strong bursts of strength in that rally off of the January 20th low, but there was no follow through. When you see strong selling followed by strong demand, you should see that demand continue if you're going to get an important rally or a bear market rally. You know, bear market rallies can be very dynamic. You know, you saw some very strong 2 to 3 month rallies in 2008 that lifted the S&P in excess of 10%. Well, we didn't see anything to indicate the market was in the process of having a type of rally like that off the January low, because every burst of demand was met immediately by a round of selling. And that just is telling us, that, again, that you've got that sell the rally mentality still alive and well. So it was our opinion that that rally off of the January low would not be sustained, and indeed the market's rolled over, and now the S&P looks like it's at, as far as its current level is concerned, we're at a new bear market low.
You know, it's going to be interesting because we are seeing the economic numbers slow down on the economy. The GDP numbers slowed for the fourth quarter. It looks like first quarter is continuing that trend. We've also seen a peak in corporate profits. So it'll be interesting to see, given the circumstances, is whether the stock market is signaling also as well an upcoming recession, because certainly Japan is caught in a recession. Europe is weakening. You kind of wonder, like, maybe we're the last man standing.
Well, by the time a recession is dubbed a recession, you know, it's after the fact. They're late. I don't remember quite the date when we were declared to be in a recession, in which month in 2008. But, you know, that's what the stock market seems to be telling us. And we've looked at various bear markets, and not all have occurred during recessions. I believe there were two exceptions going back to the 1940s, I believe. So it's not a cut and dry that you you know, need a recession to be in a bear market, but what the stock market is telling us, given that it's a leading indicator, that our economy is slowing down and it just appears to be getting started.
Well, it's also interesting because on the week that we're having this discussion, Janet Yellen is on Capitol Hill, and the Fed first raised the question of negative interest rates. So maybe they see something weakening as well and are worried that maybe this could evolve into a recession. Well, listen, Tracy, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about what you do at Lowry's, tell them how they could do so, please.
They can visit www.lowryresearch.com to learn about our company, our history. We've been around since 1938. You can go to www.lowryondemand.com as well and, you know, check out the websites, and we'd be happy to set up anyone who's interested with a trial for the service.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program today as my special guest is Judy Barr. She's yoga manager at the Cleveland Clinic Wellness Institute. And Judy, before we get into the particulars of yoga, I wonder if you could give our listeners a little bit of your background, because I think you woke up to these horrific pains in your mid-40s, and you were told that you had the back of an 85-year-old and would likely end up in a wheelchair. That's not the kind of thing that one wants to hear when you're in your 40s, because we think we're at the prime of our life.
You bet. It was something that was not very easy to believe, although I had lived with chronic pain for about 5 years or so, a little bit more, just begging to have people, you know, somebody help me figure this out. And although I went to plenty of different doctors and physical therapists and psychologists and all, it shook down to, no, you have a back of an 85-year-old person, this is what you have, and you potentially will be crippled as time goes on because your back is so bad. And I thought, wow, that's pretty hard to believe. But, you know, the pain definitely said otherwise.
Well, for investors, it's been a tough year. Just about everything is down this year. Stocks are down, but the only thing doing well are treasuries and gold. Joining us on the program is Frank Holmes from U.S. Global. Frank, let's begin with gold. It was almost dormant in negative territory, and now it's up, what, 16% for the year. What do you attribute this recent move to gold? I know you've talked about the love trade before, but is it global anxiety and fear of another crisis?
It's another crisis, but of what will be the cause of it. It won't be a banking crisis like we had before. But I think that this tipping point you really start to see when Japan came out with minus 25 basis points interest rates.
We also had the Fed mention negative interest rates on Capitol Hill this week.
Yes, so that just validated what we've been talking about this a long time, that when gold hit 1900, we had minus 300 basis points, or 3% in the 10-year government, and people didn't see the invisible rate hike. It went to plus 2%, only because everyone's so focused on Fed funds. Fed funds is only one small part of the equation. And what happened before in previous currency wars, if you go back to the 70s and 80s, we had interest rates were 6%, 8%, or 12%, and they would drop rates. So if my country was offering 12% and I dropped it to 6% and my currency got crashed, so people could see, oh, yes, because interest rates dropped, that the nominal rate dropped. Really, what's key is the real rates is what drops or rises interest rates. And because the world's been basically close to zero or at zero interest rates, seeing real interest rates has been invisible to them.
And so when you see this, we have more countries have gone to negative interest rates. We have them in Europe, Sweden. We have them in Japan now. And you even have the Fed talking on Capitol Hill this week of the possibility, whether it be legal or not, whether they can go. But apparently they indicated they're exploring that possibility. Frank, we know that gold doesn't pay anything. It's an asset that holds value. Does negative interest rates make gold more attractive?
Absolutely, because we went from plus 300 basis points to minus 300 basis points, and we had gold go from 700 to 1,900. I mean, it's remarkable. So right now, if you look at Canada, Australia, and South Africa, they even have bigger negative real interest rates. So those currencies have taken it more on the chin. And I think that that's what's really important for investors to recognize that. But gold's had a spectacular run, but some of the bigger runs have been the gold stocks. In particular, countries where they have weaker currencies like Canada, Australia, and South Africa, many of these gold stocks have jumped 100%.
You know, Frank, we've seen over the last couple of years, gold has done very well in other currencies. It's done well in the euro. It's done well in the Japanese yen. It has not done well in the U.S. because of a rising dollar. Is negative interest rates, could that be the catalyst for the, or let's say if we were to go in that direction, could this be the catalyst everybody's been waiting for in the gold market, or do you think that it's going to take something else?
You got it. What's happened to 10-year government bonds? What's happened to 5-year government bonds? They've all fallen, and the CPI number hasn't fallen. So you have a compression in positive real rates of return. They're falling. They're in the direction of going negative. If we see 10-year government bonds go down to 1% and 5-year go down to 50 base points, we're living in negative interest rates again. And that will propel gold to 1,500.
So you think that on this next run-up, we could see gold get back up in those levels that we saw probably around 2010, maybe not as much as 2011? I mean, do you think we could take out the old highs of 1,900?
So just remember when we had 1,900 ounce of gold, it was minus 300 basis points on 10-year government bond. That was the negative carry. So we're not there yet. So as we get closer to that number, then gold will run back to 1,900. I think that that's the key factor. On the supply side, that's peaking. On the demand side, there's other important developments in the capital markets. And one is that China and India consume 42% of all the gold. It's and China alone consumed all the mine supply of the world last year's mine supply. And I think that when we look at those numbers and you add central banks as net buyers last year, especially in the fourth quarter, there's currency wars going on. And the other positive part is that gold's had this big rally, and Venezuela's been selling their gold, and it's been easily absorbed. So I think that these are other really constructive components for the gold market. But the last part, which lends itself that we could easily have a correction, because historically gold rallies to the Chinese New Year, and we've had this two-year high, which is very positive, but it's also coinciding at the same time of Chinese New Year. And I think that whenever we've had this type of a percentage move over 2 months, we get a correction. So it would be a non-event for gold to correct $25, $50 and maintain this positive cycle we're in.
So let's also talk about the gold stocks, which are more leveraged to the price of gold. Frank, after peaking at 1900, we've seen a lot of the juniors disappear as financing dried up for the sector. We've seen a lot of the major companies resort to high grading on their deposits. And we haven't really, at least I haven't heard, you probably know more about this than I, that there's been some really major significant gold discoveries. So we know these large companies, I don't care if you're talking about Newmont or Barrick, are continuing to produce gold each year, but what are they doing to replace the gold that they're finding? So do we run into an issue in terms on the supply side in the years ahead?
I think we do. I think that there's been no significant commercially viable discoveries of more than 3 million ounces. In fact, very few 3 million ounces. Two, there's been mine closures continue. And three, opening of new mines has basically stopped, come to a halt. So there is going to be a slow, gradual turn, like the big Queen Mary boat in the harbor, turn here of supply shrinking from the gold mines. And I think that that is no doubt the cheapest assets are listed. You can buy some of these juniors, but with huge reserves in the ground. I think that that's where you're going to see the next wave of majors buying these assets. But they've been reluctant to go and buy them because the environmental permitting process is so expensive and so difficult and has been fraught with so many delays and disappointments that until a junior company can get their company through the pre-feasibility study, the seniors won't buy them.
And how many of those companies are out there right now? Because I'm sure the same thing is going to apply to the oil industry, which is pumping out oil at low prices, but no major discoveries, although we know that fracking and shale can still bring a lot of supply online. How many of these companies are out there now? I mean, how many companies survived the downturn that we saw over the last 3 or 4 years?
Well, I think how many survive is a different point. Is how many companies have really good assets underneath their shell? And I probably, say there's 20, 25 of these companies that are big in resources, and people are looking to, resuscitate some of them, or they're walking but wounded. If you have a big discovery today, people yawn, so there's no enthusiasm there. But I think if gold tax on, gives a little correction here and tax on $100, that there'll be some more life that'll come back in the juniors.
Yeah, especially if the stocks of these companies go up. I'm sure, at least in the past, it's when you've seen great movements in stock prices that a lot of these companies have been willing to use their stock as currency to take out others. I want to move on to the oil market next. On the Friday that we're speaking here, we've got oil prices back down in the $27 range. It looks like oil is still continuing along a downward path. We've had some brief rallies with talks of Saudi Arabia maybe getting Russia to cooperate on reducing production. We've seen those rumors come and go. What's your take on oil here? Have we bottomed, or as some analysts are saying, we could see $20 and possibly $10 oil?
Well, Citigroup analysts are calling $20 for 2 years, and Goldman Sachs is now calling $20. It's possible. A lot has to do with global trade. If you look at, I published a piece a couple of weeks back, looking over 20 years of global trade. And last time we had some really great global policies for growth was the WTO agreements. And when they came in 2002, you saw all the emerging countries take off. And you saw the dollar value of trade between all these countries taking off. So you had oil rising, you had gold, copper, iron ore, coal, you had shipping rising, and you had our stock market rising too. And since 2011, you've seen nothing but money supply in the emerging markets shrink and fall, and you've seen global trade shrink and fall. And I'm a big believer that we've tilted the weight scale on regulations. Global regulations have become so extensive and expensive. I mean, they just think that prominent law firms, there was a Wall Street Journal article, getting $1,500 an hour, and the minimum wage is $750. That's a 200 times difference in price. 200 times. There's not many CEOs that I know that are making 200 times their minimum employee. They're not taking that type of compensation. And if you take a look at the overall, just took the S&P as an average, it's not even close to that. So you have why? Why is that? Because there's so many rules and regulations, you need lawyers to turn around. And that becomes a friction on the economy. We need good lawyers, but we need things where they're streamlined to facilitate trade. And the Trans-Pacific Partnership is supposed to be signed this year, which would drop 18,000 tariffs for about 25% of the world global trade. That would be very positive. But this idea that I saw in Colombia where they tax every dollar transaction in Europe, every time when your money goes into the paycheck, they're going to take a basis point. Every time you pay for your rent, buy gas, buy food, whatever, every time a basis point, a basis point, a basis point, a basis point. That's happening in Australia. All these taxations and regulations slow down global activity.
It's absolutely amazing. And we saw this happen in Japan last year with Abenomics, or it was maybe the year before, where they came in with all this monetary stimulus and then they raised taxes. It was encouraging to see that the prime minister is holding back on raising the sales tax further. But you're absolutely right. In fact, this week, the president proposed a $10 a barrel tax on oil to be added by the government. So taxes and regulation, people don't understand how that retards economic growth, and then they're scratching their heads and wondering why we're not seeing 3% economic growth.
And if you go into the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, has a great website, and they have lots of data, and they do great presentations explaining the cost of all these regulations and what it's doing to small businesses and the difficulty. So I think that this is a factor that leads to lower oil prices, is that there's just so many barriers to economic growth. We need to unleash it. I also think that the fracking technology and the quickness that they can move is very different than a gold mine. It's very difficult to go and bring a gold mine into production. And it's not so fast. And I mean, it's much faster to go and start doing onshore drilling. Remember, oil used to, our big wells were hundreds of millions of dollars up to $1 billion in the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, these are big, big platforms. Here, there's much less money and they mobilize on trucks. So the ability to move quickly and to turn on that supply is staggering.
So given this, and let me get your comments on one other commodity here, which is copper. It's always been called Dr. Copper, and maybe copper prices are reflecting this slowdown that the market seemed to be worried about, that we're seeing, whether it's in the emerging markets, Japan, even in Europe, and now even a slowdown in the U.S. What's your take on copper here, and what is it telling you?
Well, copper is just a classic commodity for global growth, and we're not seeing it. We need to have that we've written about it called PMI, and we need to get the Purchasing Manufacturers Index turning up. The global PMI is still negative. For the 1 month, it's below the 3 months, and China's below 50, the hurdle rate. And when we've had that above, that is a good precursor for commodity demand, particularly copper and oil picking up.
So, Frank, given what you're seeing right now, we're still seeing weakness in oil. We're seeing weakness in economic growth. We are probably heading more towards currency devaluations. So we're seeing gold prices pick up. Would you be waiting for a pullback, as you mentioned earlier, to dip your toes into the gold market, and especially gold stocks? Or would you selectively start buying at this point?
No, I think that to any type of a pullback, you nibble on some quality. You put it into our gold funds or actively managed, and we outperform the GDX, the GDXJs. Or you go out and you buy, you know, some high-quality gold mines. And one of my favorites is low risk relative to the other volatile mines is Franco-Nevada. They just raised $800 million of cash. They have no debt on their balance sheet. Their revenue is about $15 million per employee. I mean, it's unbelievable intellectual capital. They collect royalties from all over the world. Their costs are in Canada, where the dollar's fallen 30%. So they're low cost structure, but the royalties are from gold all over the place, and gold in U.S. dollar terms is rising. So I think that that's a way to play it. The other part is to share with you and your listeners is that, you know, I've always advocated a 10% weight in gold, and we balance every year. Is also, we have a short-term tax refund called NEARX, N-E-A-R-X, short-term munis. And it's posted, it's up 1% year to date versus the market being off dramatically. So the idea of having diversification to gold and short-term munis like this is just really helpful to, so that you can manage this volatility and you don't emotionally become distraught. And that fund's done this for 21 years. It's had positive performance.
All right. Well, listen, Frank, you write every week as we close. If our investors would like to find out more about what it is that you do at U.S. Global and the things you write about, how can they do that?
Go to usfunds.com, usfunds.com, and sign up for the Investor Alert or the Frank Talk blog.
We've been speaking with Frank Holmes. Frank, as always, thank you so much for joining us on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
Same with you. It was a nice long weekend. Enjoy.
Coming up next, the big picture, two parts to the big picture today. It's probably going to be one of the most important big pictures we've done in recent times. If you look at most of the indicators and indexes, the S&P 500, the Dow, the NASDAQ, the Euro STX, the Nikkei, everything's down except gold so far, and treasuries are really anemic. What does all of this mean? It's really clear there are changes in the air, and a recession might be lying just ahead. And then they talked about it this week. You never thought you'd see it come to our shores, but interest rates, not just interest rates, negative interest rates. Is that a possibility for the Federal Reserve to implement? And the answer is, well, they're thinking about it. So what does all of Janet Yellen's testimony this week before Congress mean? We'll go into both of these subjects in depth. All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.